The presentation is on investment, insurance, and risk management for aquaculture development by Dr. Clement Tisdale. Clement Tisdale is a professor emeritus in the School of Economics at the University of Queensland, Brisbane, Australia. He was founding member of the International Association of Aquaculture, Economics, and Management, and for several years served as its vice president and then its president. Also in the initial years, he was co-editor of the association's journal, Aquaculture Economics and Management. He continues with research on the economics of aquaculture. Please, Professor Clement.
Well, of course, I'm presenting this paper on behalf of a panel, and I'd like to thank all those panel members who have made suggestions or contributions on the various drafts. And I'd also like to thank the FAO for inviting me to prepare the paper. So that's for those, let me get down to business. The Bangkok Declaration and Strategy for Aquaculture Development Beyond 2000 emphasized that the continuing development of aquaculture depends heavily on adequate investment in aquaculture. It identified several barriers to investment in aquaculture and suggested strategies to reduce these barriers and expand aquaculture investment. These barriers include the difficulties which aqua farmers face in obtaining finance for investment, their limited access to insurance, and the problems they face in managing the high levels of risk and uncertainty associated with their enterprises. The full paper highlights studies by the FAO since 2000, identifying policies to promote investment in aquaculture, to extend insurance cover, and improve risk management. But there is one paper that they forgot to send to me, so I couldn't mention that, but maybe if I revise the paper, I will, and that is to do with the various sources of risk in aquaculture. So that's one little thing I won't be able to cover too much. It reviews the objectives and recommendations for promoting investment in aquaculture contained in the declaration. It considers recent trends in aquaculture production and the implications for aquaculture investment, examines continuing obstacles to aquaculture investment, particularly difficulties in managing high levels of risk and uncertainty, and the limited availability of insurance cover for aqua farmers. Objectives for investing in aquaculture in the Bangkok Declaration. There were four broad objectives for aquaculture development investment that I can discern. One was to promote sustainability. Two was to foster good management of aquaculture. The third was to ensure the efficiency of aquaculture. And the fourth was to alleviate poverty. They are indicative of factors that should be taken into account in aquaculture policy and investment, but do not provide a definitive operational guide for determining aquaculture policy. Quite a few of the recommendations in these kind of declarations are very general. We sometimes call them motherhood statements, but they're not quite like that, but they're often not too definitive because this is the way policies are made. A number of useful specific suggestions were also made. These included complementary public investment is required if private investments to yield its full potential. And that's very, very important. Infrastructure must be provided and so on. A government should subsidise, facilitate private investment in newly emerging types of aquaculture and in aquaculture in new locations. I think the rationale behind that is they're particularly risky and without some inducement they mightn't happen. And public investment is needed to support rural investment and small-scale aquaculture in developing countries. Another suggestion or recommendation was that the public sector should encourage private sector investment in projects and infrastructures yielding community-wide benefits. For example, processing plants and coal stores for aquaculture in rural areas. And the government should develop mechanisms to encourage environmentally and socially responsible aquaculture investment in aquaculture. Also, establish credit schemes that support sustainable aquaculture, for example, microcredit programs. International financial institutions and assistance agencies should be made more aware of financial needs of aquaculture and the positive contribution that investment in aquaculture can make to poverty alleviation. To a large extent, these recommendations are also indicative of specific investment issues rather than definitive. What are the major obstacles to private aquaculture investment I'm going to consider? Well, small aqua farmers find it difficult to obtain finance because of the high risk of returns from this investment, the relatively high cost of transacting small loans, they have inadequate collateral, and the whole problem is made worse because the access of aqua farmers to insurance is limited. So high risks, lack of finance and insurance limit private investment in aquaculture. Now, of course, and as I'll mention later, we don't want to encourage people to take out loans who can't repay them. We see in the United States what happens when they do that. You know, what happens with the housing crisis. So, on the other hand, you don't want small farmers taking loans when they get themselves in difficulty, otherwise it's suicide or something like that. So let us, some people say, well, finance is the main obstacle. But really, I'm not so sure. Barriers to expanding aquaculture and emerging investment issues. Before addressing the chronic issues just mentioned, let me consider an emerging issue. According to recent FAO findings, the growth rate of aquaculture production has started to fall. That's a percentage growth rate. After a long period of accelerated growth, it's still growing, but it's not growing at nearly as fast a rate. Now, why has that happened? The decline probably reflects a falling rate of return on extra aquaculture investment, a decline in the rate of that aquaculture investment, and growing constraints on resource availability. And I think there's another thing which I didn't mention in the paper, which was occurred to me as a result of some of the papers given here, including the one by Carlos, that a number of the aquaculture industries are getting to be mature. The salmon industry is one. And we know from sort of business economics that the typical thing is that these industries go through a kind of a logistic or a sigmoidal curve of growth. And as they, in the early stages, once they get going, they make high profits. And then later on, people enter and so on, and prices may even come down, so the profits become lower. And so that could be another contributing factor, because probably the mainstays of the fish aquaculture have now been the ones that have been established for some time. But, why is that slowdown? Well, apart from the one I just mentioned, most sites that provide the highest returns on aquaculture may already be utilised. That's not to say you might not find some other sites that are good, but probably the best ones are already used. And because of economic growth, there's increasing competition from other industries and users for natural resources used by aquaculture, especially fresh water. After all, agriculture is a big user of water, and it needs water, but urban populations also need water. But so does industry. The steel industry uses a terrific amount of water. So they're all in competition with those other places. And then we have sustainability and environmental concerns that are also growing constraints, apart from this product cycle thing I also mentioned. What are the implications? Future expansion of aquaculture production is likely to become more dependent on its intensification and less reliant on its extension. Extension will still occur, but probably intensification will occur. This is basically what happened to a great extent in agriculture. Therefore, the expansion of aquaculture production would depend more heavily on scientific and technological advances. And in turn, that will make it more dependent on investment in R&D and on innovations. And I suppose there another thing could be important, could be how you market the product. We always talk about science and technological advances, but marketing is also a very important aspect, I think, in selling. Someone said that the Norwegian salmon industry was going through a crisis because of a glut of salmon about 10 years ago, but by various means they made a comeback. It's a part of the equation. It's not just one thing. But R&D is obviously very important, as we heard from the lecture this morning. A future investment in aquaculture will involve capital deepening rather than widening. That will increase the ratio of capital to other resources used in aquaculture. Apart from the greater use of man-made physical capital, increased human capital will play a vital role in determining future productivity. These are smart solutions. I thought the paper this morning was very interesting. The research was going on in looking at microorganisms, the potential of those to affect the digestion and that of various species. And obviously that's a human capital. Someone's smart in thinking that out. It's not that it's a lot of money involved. You know, it's more a matter of human capital and that type of thing. Now, environmental and sustainability issues will remain important influences on aquaculture investment. But I always remind people that what is sustainability? And for a lot of people, it's what they mean it wanted to mean. Sustainability can be quite an open-ended thing. And for instance, there are many things we don't want to sustain. So we don't want to sustain some things, and then you've got to make a value judgment about what you want to sustain. And this gets hidden under the carpet often. And, of course, risk and uncertainty will continue to hamper investment. Sources of risk and uncertainty. Well, farmers face risk and uncertainty in two main fronts. I'll just go ahead on that. On the production side, there's uncertainty about productivity or yields due to uncertainty about morbidity or mortality of livestock. And for those involved in commercial farms, there's uncertainty about market prices. There's uncertainty about price of inputs and prices of outputs. And combined, of course, there's uncertainty of level of economic return. Now, I was interested to read, there was a FARN newsletter was given out to us. And I see that the FAO, in conjunction with a Norwegian university, I think, is now starting to do an index of fish prices. And what you learn from that is that recently the real price of fish is falling and also that it fluctuates a lot throughout the year. It oscillates. Now, I believe that the price uncertainty probably in the aquaculture and fisheries is much greater than in agriculture. So it's a very risky from that point of view. But there are other things that make it quite risky. So that's just looking at that. Now, aquaculture yields are subject to much uncertainty because most aquafarmers have little or no control over many variables influencing their yields. These include water quality, weather conditions, and so on. Now, the amount of control that you have often depends on how much you invest and also on how well you try to manage the place. Now, those people who don't try to manage it well will not be able to respond too well. Now, one of the big risks in aquaculture is the sharing of water bodies. Wait on next one. Now, this is just an example of some different ones where sometimes you have, like the cages in case one, would be in a shared water body. And so this is an open system, so diseases can go from place to place. You can get overcrowding. You get, say, too many people going to one spot, and this reduces the oxygen levels, or it reduces the feed available for the others, and that's quite uncertain. Then if you're having intakes to ponds and then returning the water, the shared water body might be carrying diseases. But if you have a recirculating system, it's probably safer, but it's more costly. It's just an idea anyway. Now, agriculture doesn't have to share resources to such an extent. So agriculture doesn't share its land, whereas in most cases, aquaculture has to share its water. So that is one of the problems. Now, consequences for investment of risk and uncertainty. Because the returns from aquaculture are uncertain and because most people are risk-averse, investment in aquaculture is reduced. This results in underinvestment in aquaculture from a social point of view. Economic theory shows that under a wide range of conditions, greater investment in this case would reduce economic scarcity and therefore could be advantageous. That's explained more in the paper. The underinvestment problem is more acute in aquaculture than most other industries because it experiences higher levels of risk and uncertainty. Aqua farmers with small holdings are less able to cope with this uncertainty and could be deserving of greater government assistance than for aqua farmers with large holdings. How can we reduce the risk in aquaculture? Well, the main sources for risk reduction are, one, appropriate actions by individual farmers themselves. After all, they can do some things too that will reduce their risk. Then voluntary social organisations may be able to help, like NGOs, and those people who provide commercial services, such as insurance companies, also may assist, and then appropriate government policies and responses can be of help. Now, but most strategies for reducing risk and uncertainty are not costless, and their benefits need to be weighed against their costs. If a farmer wants to reduce his risk and uncertainty, it's going to cost him some time and effort and expenditure. So he's got to look at whether it's worth it for what he gets from it. This implies that if the cost of a risk-reducing action exceeds its benefit, it cannot be justified on economic grounds. And only limited risk-reducing action might be economic, because beyond some point, the cost of greater action exceeds its benefit. So it's a pipe dream to think that it would be economic to get rid of all the uncertainty and risks in aquaculture. In fact, many may not be worth getting rid of at all from an strictly economic point of view, because it costs too much to get rid of them. Now, as I said, farmers may reduce their risk by improving their farm management, greater diligence, for example, checking their animals more often, selecting species and techniques involving lower risk. Someone pointed out this morning that now, or it was yesterday maybe, that with the cages that go down deep, they've developed cages that are less subject to cyclone damage and so on. But probably they cost more. Limiting their indebtedness is another way. If you get into too much debt, that includes increases your risk. You limit your investment that could result in high sunk costs, irrecoverable capital outlays. Now, a lot of small farmers can't invest in big capital. So they don't want too much sunk cost, because if the thing goes wrong, what are they going to do with the capital? They could diversify your production. It's another way. And you can take out insurance if it's available. A lot of small farmers in Asia will be diversifying their production and might have aquaculture as a sideline. Now, as I said, none of them are without some costs, and many of the risk-reducing strategies result in total output from aquaculture being below its economic potential. What I mean there is, if everybody takes this action, then the total output will be lower, whereas maybe if you gave them a little bit of a subsidy and they didn't take that action, the total output would be higher. So usually the adoption of private risk-reducing strategies have a private and a social cost. Voluntary social actions to reduce risk. Aqua farmers can cooperate. They can engage in some sharing of risks. They can adopt collective action to control environmental spillovers, like control of diseases. Some people are advocating these, I don't know what you call them, but groupings of people together for that purpose. They can undertake collective action and supervision to increase access to insurance. But, of course, voluntary social cooperation is often difficult to achieve and can be fragile. NGOs and risk reduction. NGOs can help aqua farmers reduce risk by providing them with microfinance on favourable terms, giving grants to aqua farmers, disseminating relevant knowledge to them, and often they can be more flexible than governments in meeting social needs. What about private insurance companies? Although guided by their own self-interests, profit-seeking, they play a positive social role in reducing risks. Their economic viability depends on the pooling of their risks and inclusion in their premiums or charge to cover their administration costs. I mean, they've got to cover their costs, so they've got to take account of how much it costs them to administer the policies. But they can't cover all risks, because the cost of insurance is too high for some farmers, especially small holders. Some risks cannot be reduced by pooling, and some events may cause large and widespread losses, such as a major natural disaster, exceeding the capacity of insurance companies to pay compensation, such as, say, the big floods in the Indus River. Now, what would happen there if the insurance companies had to cover that? I mean, they'd all be broke, wouldn't they? And then, of course, there's also the question of high moral hazards. The problem here is that the farmer may say he lost his fish, but maybe someone took him away. So that's a problem, although some ways of overcoming it have been suggested. Now, FAO experts have considered various schemes discussed later involving cooperation between governments and private insurance companies that could extend insurance cover. But there are some hurdles to overcome in implementing these. Government intervention. Governments can intervene to reduce aquafarmers' risks, but governments have limited resources. Intervention is not costless, and therefore priorities are needed. I often hear at these conferences people say the government should do this, that, and the other. But the government won't do all those things. You've got to have some priorities. A government means of intervening includes subsidising the investment or production of aquafarmers, underwriting their losses in particular cases. So if the insurance company won't cover the full loss, maybe they'll make up some margin. Government intervention to reduce aquafarmers' risks. Provision of appropriate information to aquafarmers can be risk-reducing. They can promote R&D, the applied results of which reduce risks. They can adopt measures that can reduce some environmental risks, for instance, the risk of adverse environmental spillovers or externalities caused by humans. So they're all ways. What about institution building and risk reduction? Other ways in which governments can reduce risk in agriculture include strengthening the property rights, it should be property rights of aquafarmers, just a typo there, ensuring clarity of the law and speedy, cost-effective legal remedies, supporting institutional arrangements that facilitate risk-sharing. Institutional structures facilitating risk-sharing include shared ownership of enterprises such as partnerships, companies, limited liability of businesses, cooperative arrangements between aquafarmers, presence of insurance companies, but small-scale aquafarmers cannot take advantage of these structures as a rule. As discussed in the background paper, private insurance cover for aquaculture is very limited and unaffordable or unavailable to most small-scale farmers. FAO experts have examined ways government policies might extend insurance cover. These policies include subsidising the insurance premiums of aquafarmers, especially those of small-scale aquafarmers, paying a portion of aquaculture losses not recoverable from a private insurers, compensating aquafarmers for losses due to natural disasters. However, this assistance may still not be sufficient to entice small-scale aquafarmers to insure. And we find that actually it is often the poorest people who don't take out insurance. They say they can't afford it. So I still think that even if you give some subsidy, a lot of people who are very poor won't take it out. And the ability of governments to compensate aquafarmers for losses caused by natural disasters depend on the scale of the disaster and the country's wealth. If it's a loss in the United States, the government can do it, or Australia, but Pakistan may have more difficulty. Conclusions. As a result of economic growth, the investment environment facing aquaculture is changing. It faces increasing natural resource and environmental constraints. Future growth in aquaculture production is likely to rely more on investment in intensive techniques of production and less on extension. But I don't think that aquaculture is alone in this business. I mean, agriculture is also facing the same difficulties. Future high levels of risk and uncertainty in aquaculture continue to constrain aquaculture investment and result in less investment in aquaculture than is socially optimal. No magic formula exists to eliminate aquaculture risk and uncertainty, but measures have been outlined that can help to reduce it. These include measures by individual aquafarmers, groups of aquafarmers, NGOs, and governments. Possible government measures are wide-ranging. They include the measures to increase the access of aquafarmers to private insurance. Oops, that seems to be it. I must have missed out on one slide. And, of course, the other thing is in the research and development activities, the government can hopefully, if they're involved, they can help. They can try to produce techniques, not just that increase profit, but also reduce the risk of the people who are to use those techniques. So it should be a consideration, I think, not just the profitability. So, okay, that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Clement. Now the floor is open for discussion. May I please invite the the panel members to the stage. We have a total of 11 panel members, and I would like to read out the names here. Tiparat, Gunma Knapp, Carol Lee Jun, Eva Roth, Terry Hansen, Curtis Jolie, Maruti Appar, Sivali Sen, Raymond Vanaroy, and Hisham Munda, please. For those who maybe the audience doesn't know, maybe you introduce, you can introduce yourself a little bit, your name and where you come from, please.
Hello, I'm Mrs. Eva Roth. I am from University of Southern Denmark, and I'm an economist by profession, like most of us here. Especially risk perception has had my interest the last year.
Hello, everybody. My name is Raymond van Anrooy. I am FVO Sub-Regional Fisheries and Aquaculture Officer for the Central Asian region, and I've done some work in the recent past in aquaculture insurance and risk management.
Okay, I think the rest of the panelists, I think you all know. They have already presented themselves this in the morning session. So now the floor is open for discussion, please. Again, please, if you can introduce yourself. Short.
And this is Deep Swar from Nepal. Thank you, Dr. Tisdell, for your very elaborative and excellent presentation. But you mentioned in your presentation that one of the constraints for the expansion of aquaculture is probably the most of the good sites had been already used. It may be true in the developed countries, but in developing countries, they have not been explored yet. In the least developed countries, there are several areas where they could be the ideal site for the aquaculture, and they need to be explored, and that is lacking. One thing. The second thing is, you say that another real constraint is, to me, is the lack of investment. In small-scale aquaculture, investment is really lacking, and no bank is ready to provide the finance because they need collateral. And most of these aquaculture sites are in the rural areas. The land value is very low. So until and unless government, respective governments put some, influence there, put some, make some, ease out these banking procedures, this is a really big problem. Third problem is, yesterday also it was discussed that aquaculture is a high-risk industry. And people's perception is that it is very risky. So there are no proper ways and means has been utilized or used for insurance. As one of the learned panelists was in Bali, where we discussed quite a bit about this insurance, but it didn't work yet. Only in certain areas. But I think we need to do a lot of effort to convince the insurance companies as well as the respective governments to promote these small-scale aquacultures. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With the first thing, of course, there are still sites available where aquaculture can be practiced. But what I'm saying is that probably if you look at the globe as a whole, the most favourable sites have been taken up. Some are probably in locations that are not so good. Some people say there's plenty of sites still in Africa. Then I heard one person say the other day there's not all that much water available there. So that's just a general point, I guess. It's not that there are not some sites left. And I think, as was pointed out this morning, we may make more use of marine areas in the future. So, but of course, that's all a cost. I think your second point was about, what was that about? There was lack of credit. Yes. But of course, I think banks and that would lend to people in aquaculture if they thought it was a profitable proposition, but I think the risks are too high. So, and I think the same with insurance companies. The small person, it costs them a lot, first of all, to issue the premium and then to check on them. And one person from the industry says also that particularly the small grower, that the management is not good, so the risks are pretty high. So, I think private industry will do this sort of thing if it can make a profit. But if it's not doing it, it's probably the best indication it's not very profitable. And this is why some people suggest that maybe some government assistance might be needed to deal with the problem. But the government will be limited also in what it can do. So this is a problem. I think it's not an easy problem to get rid of, because everything, as I said before, risk, even getting rid of risk, is an economic cost. So this is a problem. But I do think this, that in relation to research and development, probably we should be thinking of big companies, they can take more risks. But species and techniques should be developed which are lower risk maybe for the smaller farmer. So I think attention should be given to that. I don't know whether or not enough attention is given to this sort of two-prong policy.
Yes, question from the back, please.
Can I? Yeah, yes. I just want to add something about the question you had about investment. And I think one of the reasons that there isn't as much investment is, as you said, related to uncertainty. And the reason there's uncertainty is because there's not very good information about aquaculture and the profitability of aquaculture. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the conference, about the need for more data. And again, I'm not somebody that thinks that data is going to solve everything, but it will reduce some of the perceptions of aquaculture being a risky investment.
On the issue of insurance, I would like to add just a few points. That, okay, in recent years, we all know there was a big financial crisis. Insurance companies tried to do everything what they could do to survive, actually, this crisis. And just recently, we got promising signs from the private insurance businesses that they are willing again to invest in making money available for the aquaculture industry. So there is still an interest to start this Asian aquaculture insurance pool, what was designed a few years ago, what was referred to by Mr. Deep from Nepal. So there is these kind of initiatives are still on the table, but we are waiting for the right moment, actually, for this. I would like to mention one more thing that, for instance, at the national level in Thailand, very recently, they organized a very good workshop on aquaculture insurance, and it looks like there that the farmers are organizing themselves and are collaborating with government and insurance industry to get this further developed, especially for shrimp. So there is promising signs there.
Other panel members want to add, please?
I'm sorry, I would like to add a bit. The problem here is, what is it that you are insuring against? Because if you speak to the farmers, it might not be always mortality, and it might not always be natural disasters or escape. That's actually the biggest problem. Because as Dr. Tistel underlined, actually, if you really wanted to insure against anything in my part of the world, you would like to insure against price fluctuations, or you would like to insure against environmental changes in environmental legal framework and management. Because if you ask them, that's what they are almost all afraid of. They are suddenly afraid that the access to water is getting changed, or that they will get very costly regulations, and that you cannot assure against. So we have to put this in another perspective.
Thank you very much. We take the next question, please.
Yes, I would also like to thank the presenter for his excellent presentation. The first part of my question has already been answered. This was on the Bangkok initiative. But if you could elaborate slightly more, I think it will be useful for the audience over here. And this relates to the work that FAO has been involved in. You refer to the aquaculture insurance pool. So what has been the experience so far in terms of implementing that particular concept in Bangkok? The second one, in your earlier slides, there was some reference to increasing investment by the government and financial institutions. I think the onus of in doing so aligns with the government. The government has to have a clear policy statement or a clear strategy, you know, and this should be reflected in a document that should be shared with the financial institutions. And in that document, if there's reference to aquaculture and a need for increased investment, it will help the international institutions like the World Bank or Asian Development Bank. The second point that I want to make is that in Bangladesh, as probably the participants from Bangladesh here as well, there's an organization called PKSF. This is a semi-autonomous organization which channels funds to farmers, to NGOs, you know. And this organization is being supported by many international organizations like the World Bank and DFID and others, you know. So this is something which, you know, the group can consider. And the third point that I want to mention is there's been no reference, or maybe there is, maybe not directly so, to corporate social responsibility. Are the private sector, or is the private sector doing something in this particular area or not, you know, providing insurance, providing credit support to the farmers? Thank you.
I think probably Dr. Van Unroy can mention, can a few of the questions that were raised, because I'm not an expert on what happens, what's happening here in Thailand. But I certainly agree that the investment in aquaculture, the government should have a policy on that, and also some guidelines for banks where they are connected, like development banks. I think that's definitely a good idea. The cooperatives. Well, I did mention cooperatives in the talk, and it has been suggested that they could play a role in the extension of insurance. By carrying out a number of the functions which the insurance company would no longer have to carry out. So this has been documented by the FAO. And I think you had another one. I don't know what that third one was. What was that one, do you know? Private sector social responsibility. Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that one, but can you tell me a little bit more what you mean by that, if you don't mind.
Microphone, please.
I mean, since the subject is, you know, how to increase investment, and there are major international plus national, you know, private sectors involved in the aquaculture sector, so one has to think, how can you involve these private sector people, you know, in channeling funds to farmers? There could be, you know, contract farming arrangement, there could be triangular arrangement. There are various ways of doing that, you know. And this is something, you know, which this particular paper can examine further. That's just what I want to say.
Oh, yes. Well, contract farming, I know, in Mauritius is taking place, sometimes subject to some criticism. So this is happening. Now, I haven't examined that because the paper is already fairly long, the actual paper. So I really haven't examined that aspect. But they certainly would have a role, but they would have to be subjected to some sort of social impact assessment as well as environmental impact assessment, I think. Thank you.
Thank you. Can we start by questions here first? Huh? You.
Okay, thank you. I'm Yuan Xinhua from China. Thank you very much for a very wonderful presentation. And also I've observed regarding the insurance, I think there is still not a very good solution for the insurance. So my question is, how far or what are the major steps to make the insurance company can adopt the fisheries or aquaculture as a very good field for the insurance company to be taken care? Because, as you know, the climate change also increased the risk for aquaculture development of the worldwide. And one of our panel members also explained what we were against for the insurance. Maybe we are following the BMPs, our GAPs, or we are encountering more disasters, our natural disasters to the farmers, or we are lack of stable of financial income. So what's your observe whether how far we can have the insurance for aquaculture and the fisheries. Thank you.
FAO has done reviews in recent years for aquaculture insurance and fisheries, capture fisheries insurance, actually mainly with the aim to document the current situation and think about how we can make insurance available to small-scale farmers and small-scale fishermen. In these reviews, it's, we found out, and these reviews are available on the internet, by the way, we found out that in some countries, like in India, like in Vietnam, like in China, there is insurance available to small-scale farmers and small-scale fishermen. Sometimes not countrywide, but in certain provinces or regions, it is available. Some of these schemes which were developed also have failed in the past, and they stopped in certain regions. In other regions, they started again. But in general, there are successful schemes available which are running, and they are functional and making actually profit for insurance companies and are beneficial for the farmers. We can provide you with examples. What we aimed at in recent years with FAO and also together in this consortium type arrangement with governments and with the private sector was to develop an insurance pool for Asia of some $20 million, what would be like a kind of guarantee fund. Unfortunately, because of the crisis, we were not able to follow that up, but we hope that we can work on that further. But individual cases, success stories, we can provide you with.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
In relation to what can be insured, I guess that's a point which is more or less raised. I mean, obviously, buildings and things like that can be insured because you can look at those. But the difficulty is, say, insuring the fish stock. And how many fish are there? And then when, say if they get disease, they must be then quickly checked to see what the situation is. So there's a fair bit of moral hazard involved in that. And if the farmers are small, it's very costly to the insurance company to check on them. So that is one difficulty, I think. But it may be possible, particularly in China or somewhere like that, to have some sort of a, I don't mean a cooperative of the old type, but the farmers may be jointly responsible in that area, and they enforce this rules to some extent themselves. They do the checking. And so maybe one can work out some way where that could be done. So that would cut down the costs, and that had been mentioned in one of your reports as a possibility. And I think in the Chinese situation, this may be a real possibility. Yes, thank you. But, you know, it was mentioned by Eva about insuring against a change in the regulations and that sort of thing. You can't really insure against that. That is a big problem. And even in Australia, sometimes the people get their property rights taken away. Like if they have animals on their property that are considered to be endangered, then they're not allowed to cut down the tree, because if they lived in the tree, they would die. So actually you can't really make an insurance against it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please. No, behind you.
Me?
Yes, please.
Thank you. My name is Winlet from Myanmar and currently with the shrimp industry in Indonesia. Well, I would say the insurance companies, whether it's for agriculture or any other operation, they also need to make money. So if they have a risk and they will not do that, it's in general. For the aquaculture sector, I think there are different types of the insurance. It's not just the production, it's also could be for the production facilities. It's like all the production infrastructures. It's like the ponds and the water supply system and things like that. So, for example, in my knowledge in Indonesia, some has some kind of the insurance. It's not for the crop, I mean the production, but we've got some for the production infrastructure. It's like the ponds and the water supply system and so on, the water gates. So if there's something happen, accidental or by a natural disaster, we can claim that. But of course, for the production wise, it's still we're still difficult to go with the insurance companies to cover up to that level. But I think this is some of the examples that I want to share. Maybe these could be replicated or in the other places. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing the information. Can we take the next questions, gentlemen? Yes, the one of the two of you first.
Hi, Deniz from Turkey. I have not have the question, just a reflection to give you the Turkish case there. In Turkey also, aquaculture is a rather young sector, and if to be honest, the fish farmer are not friendly to become the insurer. So the Turkish government, as a minister of agriculture, we have the new program. We are supporting and 50% of their insurance cost to encourage them to be insure their farms. Of course, big companies already have their insurance, but our target is medium level or small level fish farmer. Now trying to push, encourage them to be insured. Of course, the sector is becoming and bigger every year, so it means risk are became the bigger and bigger. So I think it will be very big importance, the insurance issues. Maybe FAO and other international organizations should be role to this issue. Maybe they can organize, we can organize all together to workshops and other meetings, events, to awareness to become the insurance. What benefit, what is the importance? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We take note of that. FAO take notes. Yes. Yes, please.
I am Abdul Hai from the Iran. Thank you, Dr. Tistel, about your presentation. I want one comment about the insurance, because insurance for the aquaculture is very important in future. And as I know, the FAO did very good expert consultation and publication about the aquaculture insurance. It was better to add some of the slide about the situation of the insurance in development country and their experience for the other countries. And I suggested if they publish the paper, the situation of the company and the private sector of the insurance is important for the other people. In Iran, we started the insurance for aquaculture by the government and subsidizing and from 10 years ago, and started from last year to study to improve the insurance for the aquaculture. Some of the issues is important for the expert to change the experience. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We, yes, one of our panel members, please.
Just a short question in return. I mean, first of all, insurance is not the only way that you can actually try to overcome the uncertainty. That's for sure, because many of the small aquaculture farmers, still in my part of the world, actually save quite more than other families do, because they want to keep their debts down so that they can overcome a bad time. The other thing they do is to try to diversify the income of the family, and that means they send their wife to work somewhere else instead of in the farm. But when you say that you are subsidizing the insurance scheme, do you do it from a business point of view where you want to help up the industry, or are you doing it from a social point of view? Because what Dr. Tistel has pledged today was that we're dealing with business, and that means that the benefit of the subsidy should be higher than the cost, or we shouldn't actually do it, because then it would be a social venture, and we don't want to subsidize an industry that is basically giving a loss time and forever.
Thank you. So we have about 5 minutes until the end of the session, so maybe I can take up 3 questions. You first, second, third.
Rubaiyat from Bangladesh. My question to Dr. Tisdall, in your paper, did you touch the topic of informal credit? Because in our country, if I give you an example, the aquaculture producers, I mean, they're heavily getting their investment from the input retailers who are providing them the feed and et cetera. And they're highly indebted due to that. So the question is, did you touch that topic in your paper, which be of real value to us?
Yes, I did mention it in the paper. The FAO has put out a paper on guidelines for microfinance, and so there's some discussion about that type of thing. And it's, of course, a very important aspect of this. And I'm wondering, in relation to that, if it is true that the loans are very risky, what happens when the credit is given out and the people can't repay it? Well, what happens then? Are they forgiven the debt, or are they hounded? Do you know?
Well, I mean, what happens, let's say this farmer, he or she has 10,000 taka, or let's say it's about how much, $200 as a loan. Now, in this season, he didn't have any crop due to, let's say, flood. Now, what happens in the next season, he has to repay back anyhow to the person from whom he had the loan taken. So, I mean, what happens then, basically the investment capacity of that farm holder reduces. So overall, the production goes down in the next season when we have a certain kind of uncertainty in the previous season. So the whole country is kind of gets into a shock, due to those kind of uncertainties if it happens. So, it would be interesting to find out an alternative so that, I mean, these producers who are taking all this informal credit can have, the repayment capacity in the next season. And basically, it's the government and it's the relief agencies who comes up and provides them the loan through which they try to cover their losses. But I think, as you said, that whether there has been any business, coming up to take that, to assume that risk, no, we haven't seen anything in practice there.
Yeah. Roel Bosma from Wageningen University. Sorry, I didn't see your whole paper yet, neither did I follow her whole lecture, but I read some interesting paper some years ago from an Australian guy, I think, that's published in a book from Circa, and he did econometric calculations on whether or not you can insure crops and investments in agriculture. And he came to the conclusion that based on economic reasons, you can't, for most of it. And he gave a strong example of the sheep business in Australia, where no insurance will whatever insure the sheep flock. They can invest in some things in it, like said. Some things you can insure, but others not. Like in cattle husbandry in Africa, you insure perhaps the first cow you give on credit through a social scheme with strong social control, where farmers control, but once it comes to the second or third cow, you don't do it anymore, because then the controls are strong enough anymore.
Any reflections from our panel members?
Yeah, it's quite true, of course, that you can't insure against everything. And as I mentioned in the paper, generally, you can only insure against things commercially where there is pooling possible. And, of course, what happens is that insurance companies, they reinsure with other insurance companies and so on. But there are a lot of things you can't insure against. And but on the other hand, it's very sophisticated, but some people buy futures. You know, we're talking about prices, right? So there's also people can take risk by buying on the futures exchange and that type of thing. But I'm not sure how good that is, and certainly a small farmer wouldn't be prepared to do that. Some big organisations certainly try to cover their risk by buying, selling forward and that type of thing. So it's a whole lot of problems there. So I certainly wouldn't want to give the impression that everything can be insured. And there are a lot of barriers to increasing insurance in aquaculture, but I think as time goes on with better techniques and better ways of monitoring and so on, that it will become more possible. So also technological advance could help extend the insurance possibilities. I think that's another possibility.
Thank you. So I think, Madam, I think you have the,
yeah, thank
this
you,
is the
Mr.
last
Chair.
Question.
And thank you for the presentation and the panelists. My name is Melba. I work for FAO. I just wanted to share with the audience some of the work that FAO does as part of its normative and field program on trying to assist our member governments in on a project that will help them to understand and apply risk analysis, because I think we have heard from everyone that aquaculture insurance is only one of risk management measures, but I should also like to emphasize that there are a number of risks in aquaculture development, and one of our projects tried to identify these risks, and we have more or less categorized it into 7 sectors. One is pathogen risk, second is not in order of priority, but one is pathogens, second is food safety, genetics, ecological, environment, social, and financial. I think the discussion here is more or less on the financial side, but we should also understand that even before going into the step of managing the risk, it's very important that we understand what the risks are, what kind of hazards we are talking about, what are the sources of these hazards, and what are the pathways that these hazards, in which direction they take, and what is the consequence of these hazards in aquaculture development. FAO has produced a comprehensive review of these 7 risk sectors, and we have tried to in that review, we tried to understand how you are able to analyze that particular risk sector. For the pathogen and the food safety risk, the risk analysis methods are pretty straightforward. It's developed because these risk sectors are governed by international agreements. They are governed by WTO SPS agreement or codex. But the other risk sectors like ecological, genetics, environmental, they are still not very well understood whether the hazard is a consequence or vice versa. So I think what I would like to emphasize is when you talk about risk management in aquaculture development, it is very important to understand first what is the risk or the hazard that you are talking about. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any comments from the panel? Not okay, let's then it's 3 and 5 minutes. We take the last question, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for the panel, because we heard everything about this. Actually, we are emphasizing upon the sustainable development of the aquaculture in another way. So as the last discussion it said, is the first we should know what are the risks and the capacity of the analysis of the risk factors in every each of the nations. This is very dependent upon the country's status. Then, the insurance is the another sector is the inputs of the ISP, and then the investment is also the depend upon the sectors who are investing. For example, in my country, is most of the agriculture sectors. The agriculture produces 22% of the total fish producing. Of these, 95% of the owners are the privates. They are investing themselves. However, government have planned to support them, but not all, but portions of these. This is our own program. For these, we should not to ask FAO or everybody's, how do we going to invest, increase the investment? It's good if FAO have any program or any organization have a program to support, to increase the investment, is we are very happy. In other way, for the insurances, so I heard from the FAO that is very good. There are a certain level of funding to establish a kind of insurances is good, but is to be a practical is important. So this is the other way. This is my comments, and this is my compliment to the presenter, Dr. Dista. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, ladies and gentlemen, now we came to the end of our expert panel presentations. Let me take this opportunity to thank our panel members and ask you to give a big hand to all our panel members.